So it's a pleasure to be invited here to speak about my forthcoming book today, particularly because this project has several links to this institution. In addition to my long-standing friendship with Andrew, I started thinking in earnest about the ideas that have gone into this book when taking an MSc in the History of Science, Medicine and Technology. It was jointly run by STS-UCL, Imperial College and Wellcome, whilst my PhD, which has something of a familial resemblance to this particular book, was examined by Dilwyn Knox. If you'll indulge me for a few minutes, I'm going to continue in this autobiographical vein to introduce some of the problems that I've attempted to address in this work. So the germ of the idea came to me some 20 years ago when I was in the final year of my undergraduate degree at the University of Edinburgh. I was studying Patricia Alliston's course on 17th century Italy, during which I encountered revisionist historiography on the history of the Italian peninsula in the 17th century. So traditionally this is a period considered to have been an era of decadence, and also works on the so-called Counter-Reformation. And during this course, I became interested in the Galileo affair, but came to realise that although historians of science had developed sophisticated ways of treating the scientific aspects of these events, all too often they relied on old-fashioned clichés when they came to consider the Catholic Church. So perhaps somewhat foolishly, I set out my postgraduate research to tell a story about the ecclesiastical censorship in early modern Italy that didn't rely on these tropes. And so here we are nearly 20 years later, I've achieved hopefully some of those aims in this particular book. So to dig into these ideas in a little more detail, it's the idea that from the mid to late 16th century, Italy became a uniquely hostile environment for practicing science. This is well established in both academic and popular thought. And so in addition to Galileo's trial, it's possible to point to the fate of Giordano Bruno and the censorship of other philosophers, including Girolamo Cardano, Francesco Petrizzi, and Bernardino Telesio. But for many years, it remained difficult, if not impossible, to assess accurately the extent of the effect of the Counter-Reformation's censorship of science, because the archives of the Inquisition Index remained closed to scholars. Their opening in the late 1990s has enabled historians to build a far clearer picture of the activities of the Inquisition and the Congregation of the Index. And perhaps the most notable contribution is by Ugo Baldini and Len Sprut, who have come through the archives identifying all of the documentation relating to the censorship of science. And they published them in these multi-volume work here. But their findings really were revelatory. Although they produced three sizable volumes of documents, they maintained that from the point of view, from the point of the Roman Inquisition's foundation in 1542 until the end of the 16th century, very few people, possibly as low as three, were prosecuted for actually practicing what they considered modern science. The remainder, they observed, were either censored or prosecuted on account of their Protestant beliefs, or because their work contained magical or superstitious content. And it's this latter insight that's been the point of departure for my book. While I don't contest the broad thrust of Baldini and Sprut's argument, I want to make the case that the censorship of forms of natural magic played an essential role in the development of modern science. And to illustrate this point, I'd like to briefly consider the case of Giambattista Della Porta. His most famous work, Natural Magic, which is pictured here, was published in two editions during the course of the 16th century. In the introduction, he explained that there were two forms of magic. The first achieved its ends by appealing to demons for assistance and was therefore illicit. The second, which he practiced, natural magic, was quite different. It was, he maintained, rooted in a deep philosophical understanding of the natural world, one that allowed the magician to understand and manipulate its laws in order to produce wondrous effects that were beyond ordinary human understanding. Della Porta was nevertheless placed on trial by the Roman Inquisition in the early 1570s, charged with practicing necromancy, that is, the illicit forms of demonic magic. And this vignette concerns the kernel of my argument. Inquisitors simply did not believe that he was able to produce his effects by natural means. This in turn opened the suspicion that they must be produced, whether or not De La Porta was aware of this fact, with the assistance of demons. In other words, Inquisitors were contesting the veracity of De La Porta's account of the natural order, its laws and the limits of human capacity to operate therein. In this sense, we are looking at rival definitions of nature's limits. And in this book, I have sought to explain how and why the Roman Inquisition came to acquire the power and authority to determine these boundaries, to understand the motivations driving these efforts, and to reconstruct the standards that they used to make such judgments. And to examine these questions, it's been necessary to consider some long-standing historiographical assumptions about the prosecution of magic in Italy. The first relates to some of the clichés about the Roman Catholic Church that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. So it's beyond dispute that the Roman Inquisition was founded in order to address the spread of Protestantism within the Italian peninsula. But whilst this is true, this belief has given rise to some misapprehensions about the reasons why this institution prosecuted cases of magic. What I'd like to suggest is that the foundations for thinking about the Inquisition magic were laid at least as early as the 1950s in the work of historians such as Luigi Firpo. In an important article, Firpo noted that once the Roman Inquisition had successfully suppressed Protestantism by around 1590s, it began to seek new targets, including literature, social mores, and increasing numbers, magicians and witches. For Firpo, then, these investigations represented an unintended and perhaps unwarranted deviation from the Roman Inquisition's original purpose and intent. Modern historians of the Inquisition continue to put forward broadly similar accounts of the Inquisition of magic. But the idea that the Inquisition started prosecuting magic only after the successful suppression of Protestantism is only supported by evidence from some tribunals. Perhaps the most important of these was the Venetian Inquisition. So here we have a table of prosecutions I've taken from Christopher Black's work, The Italian Inquisition. It's largely based on John Tedeschi and William Monta's groundbreaking statistical studies of the Roman Inquisition. Here we can see that Lutheranism was indeed the most investigated offence in Venice, at this half of the table. In this period, 1547 to 1585, was 717 cases. And it declined to just over 109 in the later period, 1586 to 1630. But next in the table is Trulli. But here we find Trulli in a similar period, 1557-1595, only three cases of what they term here apostasy from the faith, which is including Lutheranism, Anabaptism, Calvinism, Orthodox views. But there are, by comparison, 62 cases of prosecutions for magic in this period. Have the next slide. Here is a table here from the Neapolitan Inquisition, 1564-1590. Here we find that the cases of prosecution for Protestantism are only 19, but when we go down to magical arts, there are 178 prosecutions. So the Inquisition here is not directly controlled by the centralised bureaucracy of that was established in Rome in 1542, but it does communicate with it. As we can see, the picture is really quite different. We can also see that while the number of prosecutions for Protestantism in Naples
remained broadly steady from 1591 to 1620. They actually accelerated here to 498 in the later period.
So there is currently only limited data from elsewhere in the Italian peninsula, but there's enough evidence here to show that the Inquisition investigated magic during the first 30 to 40 years of its existence. It may have intensified, but it did not begin as a consequence of the suppression of Protestantism. And this point is reaffirmed by the fact that from as early as the late 1540s, the Roman Inquisition were producing indices of forbidden books that sought to control various learned operative arts, including forms of theurgic magic, exemplified by texts such as the Clavicula Sermonis, but also ostensibly natural arts such as predictive astrology, physiognomy, and chiromancy. So where did the impetus to censor such arts come from? Well, it's often assumed that the Inquisition was essentially enforcing doctrine that had been defined at the Council of Trent, which met in three periods during the 16th century, 1545 to 49, 1551 to 52, and 1562 to 63. But a point that's been made by Simon Ditchfield and John William O'Malley, was that many of the reforms that were associated with the Tridentine era don't actually originate in Trent, and magic is a case in point. It was never discussed in any at Trent. So where is it coming from? And what I want to argue is that we need to examine who these inquisitors were and what they wanted to achieve in addition to the suppression of Protestantism, and moreover, to draw connections with earlier practices of Inquisition. And this focuses the story on members of the Dominican Order and the long history of their involvement in Inquisition from the 13th century onwards. So, having set out some of the historiographical context, I'd like to use the remainder of my time to set out some of the structure and key arguments of the book. Well, that's was an image of chiromancy, which we've skipped on from. So the purpose of this book is to examine how the Roman Catholic Church set the parameters for making knowledge about the operations of the natural order in the period broadly from about 1000 to 1564. It is in this sense a contribution to the history of science, although it doesn't always concern material that would be traditionally viewed as scientific. The society that we're considering in this book held assumptions about the natural order that were radically different to those presupposed by modern science. Pre-modern Christians sought to understand a cosmos that they knew was created by God, which they believed that he had populated not only with humans and animals, but also angels, some of whom had fallen to become demons. Prior to circa 1750, and perhaps later, intellectuals who wished to offer a true account of the natural order often felt compelled or were obliged to take account of the actions of God and his creatures, such as angels and demons. The potential explanatory repertoire that pre-modern intellectuals could draw upon to comprehend observed or reported phenomena within the natural order was, therefore, far wider than that allowed by modern science. But the acceptance of this wider explanatory field did not mean that the ideas of pre-modern Christian intellectuals were irrational, or that they always understood the natural order in terms of divine or angelic causation. At the heart of most accounts of nature in the pre-modern era lay the idea of the cosmos, a depiction of the natural world derived from Greco-Roman philosophy. The majority of scholars believe that God's creation followed fixed, predictable laws, which humans could comprehend, albeit imperfectly. The tenets of their faith nevertheless require Christians to acknowledge the existence of a providential God and his creatures, including angels and demons. And the acceptance of these beliefs in turn compelled them to accept that the rules that ordinarily governed the operations of the natural order could be disrupted. God and God alone could break the rules that he had established in order to perform miracles. That is, to produce naturally impossible effects such as restoring the dead to life. But since angels and demons were God's creatures, and hence part of the natural order, they could not break his laws. They nevertheless understood and possessed a capacity to manipulate God's laws that surpassed those of humans. Consequently, they could produce wonders that defied ordinary human understanding. To a lesser extent, humans too could manipulate these laws to produce their own wonders. Humans could also solicit the assistance of angels or demons to perform work on their behalf. During the medieval and early modern periods, Christian intellectuals, including the inquisitors discussed in this book, sought to determine whether any particular effect or particular arts that purported to produce that effect could be attributed to either natural causes, the routine functioning of natural nature's laws, or their legitimate manipulation by humans, preternatural causation, that is, the manipulation of nature's laws by demons, or supernatural causation, God's direct action to break the laws of his creation. As Stuart Clarke has noted, pre-moderns' willingness to attribute effects to either preternatural or supernatural causation did not represent an acknowledgement of their failure to comprehend those effects. On the contrary, for contemporaries, to be able to assign a given event to either a preternatural or supernatural cause was to know its causes. The central problem facing Christians in both these periods was determining which category of causation a given event or effect should be attributed to. They needed to know whether it had been produced by the ordinary workings of nature, induced for a human artifice, or whether they lay beyond human capacities. If they were considered to lie beyond the ordinary capacities of human beings, it raised the possibility that the person who created that effect had solicited the assistance of demons and was therefore liable to censure by the church. Consequently, it was essential to understand precisely what effects could be produced by unaided humans, and which effects were so remarkable that they could only be produced by demons. To make these determinations, contemporaries had to demarcate the limits of human ability to understand and operate in nature, a task that they accomplished by drawing on a range of resources, including not only theology, but also natural philosophy. Now, studying the Inquisition of Magic offers a means to explore how medieval and early modern Christians understood and defined nature's limits, and the means by which they disseminated and enforced them. The investigation of learned magic forced inquisitors to situate the effects that an operator claimed to produce on an explanatory grid that included natural, supernatural, and preternatural causation. But the boundaries between these categories were often unclear, and more importantly, the criteria used to make these judgments were contested. In the medieval and early modern periods, contemporaries practiced, theorised, criticised, and feared a wide range of different magical arts. These included forms of magic, both learned and popular, that explicitly required making contact with demons, those that intentionally subverted Christian ritual, and those which involved groups of erstwhile Christians gathering in groups to worship the devil. And while in this book I discuss numerous forms of magic in the pre-modern period, I focus on a much smaller set of operative arts. the operators of such arts, such as making astrological talismans, or those who practice chiromancy, that's palm reading, claim that although they were able to perform wonders beyond ordinary comprehension, whether manipulating nature to produce unexpected effects or procuring privileged knowledge of the future, they made no explicit appeal to angels or demons, and their art contained no ritual element. Instead, they claim they work their wonders by entirely natural means. Such arguments were rejected by some within the church on the grounds that they could not work in such a manner. But by seeking to regulate the practice of these disputed arts, a subsection of the field of magic, the church defined the legitimate boundaries of natural knowledge. To put it anachronistically, they defined the limits of science. Now, my central claim in this book is that prior to the establishment of the Roman Inquisition in 1542, the criteria used to determine the boundaries between legitimate human activity and illicit preternatural magic was subject to debate within the Catholic Church. Prior to this time, there was no universal standard for judging the legitimacy of ostensibly natural arts. There were, however, clear arguments rejecting them. I argue that the intellectual and institutional roots of the Roman Inquisition's prosecution of magic, and especially the prosecution of ostensibly natural arts, can be traced to the writings of Thomas Aquinas. After 1542, the Roman Inquisition began to impose a broadly coherent set of criteria derived from the thought of Aquinas that was, in principle at least, binding on all Catholics. So I included this slide on the right because I only became aware of just how bad Aquinas' handwriting was this week. I recalled an experience I had sat in the archives looking at Cardinal Bellarmine's handwriting, and I sat for a whole morning with my head in my hands, just despairing. But it wasn't quite as bad as Aquinas. In this manner, they made important strides towards defining nature's limits. The incorporation of Aquinas' ideas into inquisitorial practice was, however, complex. For nearly 250 years, Aquinas' discussion of the legitimacy of arts such as astrological talismans and chiromancy were, at best, marginal to inquisitorial practice. And so in this book, I trace how these Thomist principles became established as the criteria of censorship within the Roman Inquisition, and by extension, how they subsequently became regarded as the standard of orthodoxy within the Catholic Church. So what this all means is that ideas are of central importance to my story. But as historians of science have stressed for over 50 years, explaining why members of a particular society regarded a particular idea, irrespective of whether they're now considered true or false, to be authoritative, requires us to examine factors seemingly external to the ideas themselves. Ideas, they've stressed, are produced by humans working within specific social, cultural, and political contexts, by humans who are driven to act by an array of imperatives, including, but not in the restricted to, disciplinary formation, institutional expectations, intellectual curiosity, personal ambition, or religious fervour. The historian's task is to reconstruct the reasons why past actors sought to legitimate and gain universal assent for ideas produced in often highly localised context, and the strategies and techniques that they deployed in pursuit of these ends. Adopting a similar approach, this book presents two interrelated stories. The first is essentially an intellectual history of Thomist thought on magic, which traces changing interpretations of Aquinas' ideas within the Dominican order between the 13th and 16th centuries. The second is an account of the Inquisition of Magic. It describes how members of the Dominican order first incorporated a Thomist conception of magic into the practice of medieval inquisitors, thereby forming a template for the investigation of learned magic that later Dominicans subsequently incorporated into the censorial structures of the 16th century church. But tracing this latter story requires us to situate the Dominicans' involvement in the Inquisition of Magic, to chart it against a long history of ecclesiastical conflict and reform that dates back to at least the age of the Gregorian Reform. The book itself is divided into two parts. The first treats the establishment of the intellectual and institutional foundations on which the Roman Inquisition was later built. It locates the origins in the period, as I mentioned, the period of papal reform from around 1000 to around 1250 AD, and traces their development to the eve of the Great Schism in 1378. At the heart of this story lies an account of the processes by which the papacy exerted its power to define Orthodox belief and to enforce those standards over Christians living in Western Europe. During this period, the papacy placed itself at the forefront of a reform programme that explicitly sought to create a homogeneous Christian society, purged of deviant thought and errant behaviour. And this process entailed both the elaboration of a set of Orthodox ideas and behaviours and the construction of a system of pastoral care to educate and discipline the people of Christendom. To help achieve these ends, the papacy oversaw the creation of two novel institutions, the Orders of Mendicant Friars and the Office of the Inquisitor of Heretical Depravity. This section of the book describes how papal inquisitors acquired the authority to investigate cases of magic, before surveying subsequent debates over inquisitors' authority to intervene in these cases, and discussions of the criteria that should be used to determine the boundaries of orthodoxy. So, going through in order, Chapter 1 examines the origins of the Inquisition of Magic. This was a novel practice that depended upon two key developments. First, it required the creation of a cadre of papally appointed officials invested with the authority to investigate allegations of heresy within individual dioceses. Now, the papacy acquired the power to intervene in this manner as a result of the reform movement of the 11th and 12th centuries. During these years, the papacy asserted its supremacy over the Western Church. It claimed the right to lead reform of Christian society by defining orthodox thought and behaviour, and to have the authority to appoint officials to intervene in individual dioceses, irrespective of the wishes of the local bishop. The primary means for these interventions were the actions of the mendicant friars, who delivered pastoral care and performed the role of inquisitors of heretical depravity. Secondly, the Inquisition of Magic depended upon the expansion of the definition of the term heresy. Since the patristic era, magic had been considered a superstition, that is, an act offered undue worship to something other than God or the saints. Church fathers such as Augustine and Isidore of Seville had prohibited the practice of virtually all operative arts on this basis. And this was a view that was reiterated in canon law during the 11th and 12th centuries. What it wasn't was heresy, which Augustine is amongst the figures to draw this distinction. Heresy was more of a thought crime. It's holding a belief rather than actually practicing a corrupted form of religion. But in order to facilitate the Inquisition of Magic, the papacy ruled in 1258 that certain forms of magic could indeed be prosecuted as heresy. And both of these developments were contested, and as we should see, formed the basis of disputes about the Inquisition of Magic until at least the 16th century. The papacy's decision to grant inquisitors of heretical depravity the authority to investigate certain categories of magic was just one of a series of transformations in the way that magic was understood in the high medieval period. Chapter 2 describes how these changes were driven by the rapid intellectual developments of the 12th and 13th century, during which the theologians and philosophers rediscovered not only the intellectual legacy of pagan antiquity, but also the church fathers' strategies for dealing with that legacy. The mendicant orders played a central role in this process by developing novel ways to employ philosophy in service of the faith. Two Dominican theologians, Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, offered innovative means to resolve conflicts between knowledge claims established in the disciplines of philosophy and theology. They also wrote extensively on the issue of magic, developing a novel rationale for identifying legitimate operative arts that was rooted in a philosophical analysis of the natural order. Using these means, they accepted the practice of a range of arts, including predictive astrology, that had been rejected not only by the church fathers, but also by the canonists of the 11th and 12th centuries. By the beginning of the 14th century, the papacy had asserted its right to appoint inquisitors to investigate cases of heresy, including heretical magic, across Christian Europe. But these new powers were not universally accepted. And Chapter 3 describes how secular and episcopal authorities contested the papacy's authority not only to appoint inquisitors in local dioceses, but also to allow the mendicants to conduct the cure of souls. It shows too how the papacy responded to these challenges by reasserting the inquisitors' authority to investigate heresy. and by reiterating the definition of heretical magic. In the bull Super Ilias Specula, the papacy argued that anyone who performed arts that involved making an explicit compact with demons should be treated in the same manner as heretics. And the papacy subsequently encouraged the prosecution of magic in all courts, whether episcopal, civic or inquisitorial. But it met with relatively limited success. The desire to assert papal authority and further the prosecution of illicit operative arts informed Nicholas Eymerich's discussion of magic and divination. In his Directorium Inquisitorum, which is a inquisitorial handbook, he drew upon the papal bull and an idiosyncratic reading of Thomas Aquinas' work to assert the inquisitor's right to investigate cases of magic. The criteria he used to define the boundaries of magic owed little to the ideas that Aquinas had developed in the Summa Theologica, and urged the inquisitor to investigate the operator's actions, rather than to consider whether the art in question was naturally possible. But despite the papacy's efforts, the prosecution of magic remained rare in the courts of 14th century Europe. So moving on to the second part of the book, it focuses on continuity and change in the Dominican Order's intellectual conception of magic, and the intensification of its efforts to combat superstition between the 15th and 16th centuries. It places these developments within the context of the radical challenges posed to papal authority by the emergence of conciliar theory in the 15th century, which questioned not only the papacy's right and ability to guide reform, but in some formulations, also the basis of papal supremacy. Perhaps the most lasting legacy of conciliarism was the development of an alternative model of reform centred on a rejuvenated episcopate dedicated to the delivery of pastoral care. To rebuild its authority within the church, the papacy sought to promote papal-led reforms. Successive popes encouraged the development of the observant reform movement. Between the 15th and 16th centuries, they supported the Franciscan and Dominican orders in their efforts to build upon their earlier social disciplinary techniques to launch their own programme of reform. It sought to encourage devotion amongst ordinary Christians, whilst protecting them from the threat posed by heresy, the presence of Jews in Christian society, and, most relevantly for our purposes, the threat of superstition. These ends were to be achieved by using means of pastoral engagement, such as preaching, hearing confession, and, where necessary, the inquisition of heresy. And the religious crisis of the mid-16th century brought to the fore tensions between these rival models of reform. They were also clearly evident during the Council of Trent. In addition to defining Catholic doctrine, the Tridentine Fathers debated the nature of reform, how and by whom it should be organised, and the precise ends to which it should be directed. So from the later 14th century, papal authority was undermined by two related crises, the Great Schism and the rise of conciliarism. And chapter 4 describes how the supporters of conciliarism mobilised long-standing complaints about the papal supremacy and articulated alternative proposals for church governance and reform based, or that was centred on the episcopate. But following the resolution of the crisis in the mid-15th century, the papacy used a number of means to rebuild its authority. They included encouraging the spread of the observant movement, which in turn allowed the mendicants to enhance and expand their pastoral mission. And certainly within Italy, the mendicants expanded their ministry. They intensified their programmes of pastoral engagement, which involved an increasingly vocal campaign against superstition. And these developments were paralleled by radical intellectual changes within the Dominican order. On the one hand, authors such as Johannes Nida began to articulate a new idea of diabolic witchcraft, beliefs which inspired a new wave of trials for magic in Switzerland, France and Italy. On the other, theologians within the order also began to engage in a more systematic fashion with Thomas Aquinas' ideas on superstition. And in the process, they rediscovered his central contention that understanding nature's limits was central to any attempt to define the boundaries of superstition. And these ideas were incorporated into inquisitorial manuals such as the notorious Malleus Maleficarum for the first time in the 15th century. They only had a limited effect on the Inquisition of magic, however. Trials for magic continued to focus on allegations of diabolic witchcraft and forms of superstition that would have been recognisable to Nicholas Amyric, rather than the practice of ostensibly natural arts. By the beginning of the 15th century, tensions between rival proposals for reform were becoming increasingly evident. The mendicants continued to pursue their pastoral ministry throughout Europe, and within Italy, their campaign against diabolic witchcraft reached a new intensity in the 1520s. Although a significant number of these trials involved allegations of diabolic witchcraft, many inquisitors also continued to prosecute older forms of superstition, particularly those, as I mentioned, that would be recognisable to Amyric. But during the same period, some Catholics proposed reforms to doctrine, while others also suggested reforms to the church and head and members. Many of these proposals centred on the episcopate, and in some instances, they also involved curtailment of mendicant privileges. These proposals held significant implications for the authority of the papacy relative to the episcopate. Disputes over these issues were played out at the Fifth Lateran Council, which took place between 1512 and 1517. To ensure that the meeting could conclude successfully without undermining papal authority, Pope Leo X carefully balanced the contrasting demands of the mendicants and the episcopate. The Council Fathers also passed a series of reform decrees, many of which related to the office of the bishop and provided a basis for later Tridentine reforms. The decrees also reiterated the importance of the mendicants' ministry generally and encouraged the pursuit of magic specifically. The decrees did not, however, offer any changes to received conceptions of magic. And the Inquisition of Magic, in many ways, continued to proceed in the same manner as it had at the beginning of the century, focusing on the prosecution of diabolic witchcraft and sorcery. In 1517, Christian Europe was divided by the actions of the Augustinian friar Martin Luther. All too often, the Catholic response to these events has been reduced to a model of definition and enforcement, which posits that Catholic doctrine and practice were established at Trent and imposed by the Roman Inquisition. As we've seen, however, many of the ideas and policies taken to be characteristic of post-Tridentine Catholicism did not originate at the Council. And Chapter 6 shows that between the 1520s and the 1540s, there emerged two distinct approaches to addressing the Lutheran challenge and the Reformation of the Church. The first, a conciliar approach, was supported by the Emperor and a number of his bishops, and it led to the convocation of the Council of Trent, which the Lutherans were invited to attend, and where fathers discussed doctrines and set out a programme of bishop-led reform. Proponents of the second approach, advocated by clerics such as Cardinal Caraffa, rejected the idea of conciliarist reform, doctrinal reform, and they objected particularly to the idea of negotiating with the Lutherans. They instead proposed that the papacy should direct a series of limited reforms, whilst rejecting Lutheran doctrine and rooting out all of those who held similar ideas. Pursuing these ambitions, Caraffa convinced Pope Paul III to allow him to reorganise the pursuit of heresy. Now, the creation of the Roman Inquisition gave Caraffa immense power, but it also had the effect of strengthening the mendicants' influence and authority within the church, especially that of the Dominicans. What I'd like to suggest is that they used it to pursue their own programme of reform, which, as we've seen, sought to deal with issues that were never considered at Trent, such as the problem of superstitious magic. By the beginning of the 1550s, the first period of Trent had been dissolved rather than formally concluded. The ecclesiastical hierarchy remained divided by two differing visions of reform, one papal and the other conciliar. Whilst the council again met inconclusively between 1551 and 1552, throughout the 1550s, Caraffa continued to use the Roman Inquisition to protect his vision of Catholicism, that is, one led by the papacy and purged of heresy. In 1554, he ascended to the papal throne as Pope Paul IV, quashing any hope that the council would be reconvened and strengthening the power of the Roman Inquisition. It's well known that during these years, Paul IV used the Inquisition to define Catholic doctrine, particularly using it against those within the Catholic Church that he regarded as heretics, such as Cardinal Reginald Pole, who had maintained beliefs similar to those of the Lutherans. This chapter shows, chapter 7, that the Dominican friars also used the Inquisition's new power and authority to advance their own reforming agenda. Using instruments such as the Index of Forbidden Books, the Dominicans sought to impose their attitudes and their reforming program towards the Jews, philosophy and magic on Christian society. Analysis of the Inquisition's indices also reveals that the Roman censors used the criteria first developed by Aquinas and subsequently rediscovered in the 15th century to define the boundaries of orthodoxy. Upon Paul IV's death, supporters of the conciliar approach reasserted their authority, leading to the reconvocation of Trent. But during this meeting, the fathers of Trent sought to roll back the excesses of Paul IV's regime and once more assert episcopal control over reform. These developments moderated the Inquisition's power, but the fathers endorsed a new index that once again accepted Aquinas's criteria for censoring science, censoring magic. There was, by 1564, now a broad consensus that in order to determine the legitimate boundaries of superstition, it was necessary to determine nature's limits. Thank you.